the topic, medical, societal, moral dilemmas. And he's good to be with us this evening to do some questioning and answering with us. And I think you have a few things that you wanted to say about behavior control, too, that I'm very much interested in. Good. Back to the podium. I wanted to answer that moral law. I was asked that moral law question. And I didn't want to take the time because I thought it would get in. I thought it was very, very, very interesting. Because it reminded me of something I had read on the airplane coming back. I always like to reread my old books. So. And in the way some people describe the newer trend is to say, In moral philosophy, it's what values and what duties do we have. And they make a couple of assumptions. The moral values and the moral duties depend on the kind of being, as we said this morning. What's the being? And then we can discover what the processes are that comprise the essence of this being by using the same techniques of reason, by examining man. And all of that sounds really good, except if we go down through the period, then we're going to have to say, what are those moral values? And then we're going to say, if we examine man, who examines man? How do they see him? Well, let's take a look at how man's been examined. And I'm just trying to show you dilemmas, even. I stick to my original idea what I believe moral law is. But if you go way back, Lucian thought the gods created man to play with. As a result, men were just only interested in satisfying themselves, and therefore went on to just go on and keep on satisfying themselves. And really, it was sort of a pessimistic point of view, and really not a very good view of men. And of course, he was looking at the Romans and probably saw the Romans and examined the Romans and had the idea that men always tried to accumulate things, always to excess more they had. And the Epicureans had the same feeling. They looked at man and said, man is interested in his own desires. So I'm just giving you the idea when people say we have to analyze something, and who's analyzing and what do they come up with? The Epicureans say that they were interested in satisfying their desires, their needs. And in fact, it's very interesting. Their desires always were just one step behind what they had achieved in material. They were never quite satisfied and always went on ahead. And so they were a pleasure-seeking type of a instrument. We get to the Christian era, and Augustine had the same idea practically. That's where he had his idea of predestination, of a certain group that will be saved, and another group that was just put there, and they're so with all the sinful traits of man, and they had to be controlled by laws of the state. God just said you had to have laws in order to do this. So St. Augustine looked at a small group with the capability of behaving. I may have sold Aristotle short today. He did say the parts have to be in harmony with himself, but he did say that with reason, one can achieve a state of harmonious behavior. Now, I have to bring that in because then Thomas Aquinas comes in with a very helpful view of what man was and what a man is capable of. And he took part of Aristotle's concepts and said man's reason could allow him to come to conclusions about what the natural laws are. Now, he believed we were all created by God and believed that the laws could be divided, I think, into three parts. If I remember now, my reference is not with me, so I have to go by memory. I think he called it natural or moral, the natural law, which he said any reasonable being can come to that conclusion. It means I shall not do any harm, I shall do good, and I shall watch my behavior. Then there was this legislative law which was required to keep people in harmony. And then, of course, there was the divine law which he believed in, with the New Testament coming in with Christ, adding now the dimension of that was missing in the first, in the Old Testament. He figured, as I remember it, and I'm not a philosopher, so I just do my reading, that what was in the Old Testament was part of what any reasonable individual could come to. When Christ came in and spoke against, not against that, he didn't speak against those rules, but he added the concept of salvation that is taking the rules that society has dictated in the Old Testament and internalizing them, making it ourselves, part of ourselves, at least. That is what we call the gospel, is to take what was said. So he really never said anything that was contradictory. Christ never said anything contradictory to the Old Testament. All he said is these rules, which can't come from reason, must be made part of us. So I think that concept of natural law, so when I was asked natural law this morning, I was put on the spot. The only answer to the question of natural law. Now, it's interesting, ideas come back. Thomas Hobbes comes back that man's a pleasure-pain machine, or sensory individual. Kant comes back and says he's a man is capable of reasoning. He's always striving for justice, equity, and attributed to man the qualities, again, in part as Augustine did, which in part as Aristotle. So, but basically, I think between Aristotle, Kant, and between Aquinas, they all agreed that natural law is something that is achievable by reason as to what man can do. I think Hobbes, the Epicureans, Lucian took the attitude, a very pessimistic attitude, of what man is. And in the Divine Comedy, Dante refers to the acquisition, this horrible greed and acquisition, these tendencies in man to acquire. And in fact, in one of the candles has a special place in hell for doctors. I think even some clergy and a few other people. But it's all interesting. And of course, it reached its part of its peak with St. Francis of Assisi, who said the acquisition of materialism, of material things, is what impedes man to achieve salvation. And then, so these concepts of natural law, I think, if people would look at it, they vary. We say it's from reason, but the question is who reasons and who sees man and who deducts from man's actions what. So we have pessimists at all times and we have optimists. So I wanted to get that one straight. So that, I think it's kind of important. Now, I like the there's a book I had which I had read from the chairman of the Department of Religion at Princeton, Thomas, a fellow named Thomas. A very nice book. Unfortunately, it's 1950, but I still think it's a good book. Christian Ethics and Moral Philosophy, and I kind of enjoy it because he points out what I was trying to say this morning, that we are constrained, and I use the word constrained not in a pejorative sense, but in a good sense, by the behavior that's been imposed upon us, by Christ's concept of internalization of the rules that we have in the Genesis, the Deuteronomy, etc. So that, and I think he makes an excellent point. And I really think it was an excellent book. At least I understood it. I was able to enjoy it. If it was too deep, I probably wouldn't have accepted it. But I think it would be very important that students get exposed to something of that type. And I don't know if it's still available. And it's called Thomas. It's by Thomas, and it's Christian Ethics and Moral Philosophy. And I think it was something I really enjoyed very much as I was coming along, and I had opportunities to read. The one thing I missed today, I didn't have time to get into, was the so-called ethics of mind control. And the control of man's mind. Now, I honestly think the others are spectacular. The genetic part, I think, is a spectacular part. I think it means that I think the responsibility of preparing young people now is really a tremendous and an awesome responsibility, because it means that they have to understand that they are part of a society and that each of their acts should be evaluated. We can expect and should expect, without apology, from Christian professionals, the application of the basic Christian Christ principles in their actions as it relates to their duties. Now, in this morning's sermon, we talked about serving God. And when I was a youngster, I was asked if I would like to be, I was raised in the Methodist Church in New York. See, I wasn't always a Lutheran as McTagg, and I was also a Methodist. So, and I was offered the opportunity to go to, if I would agree to be a minister, I could go to either Princeton or Columbia and then go to that seminary. Well, I thought it over, and I thought it would be best for the church if I abstained. And but like Jonah, I got swallowed up, and I get someplace along the line, and I got thrown up on the beach again, somewhere along the line. So I became a little earthen vessel, I suppose, and I got the flaws in it. But anyhow, getting back to I think the students have to be made to recognize that this is their responsibility. It's, we could testify for Christ in our professions, whether we're plumbers or anything, regardless of what we do. And the opportunity need not be one necessarily of opening the Bible as much as leaning forward and saying that this, I am doing this for you because I'm expected to do it for you, and then explain why. And this is why I've liked my job. I've had the opportunity on more than one occasion. In fact, on many occasions to do it. But I think that that's the way, if we're going to witness, we have to witness in our actions for other people. And I think we are constrained by these principles. We should be ready, however, and I think the students are not prepared properly. And you don't mind my saying this now, I hope. Do you? Do I ask them freewheeling? I think the students will not be prepared properly if they cannot meet people, their arguments, at their level, because God gave us a sense of reasoning. Now, if I want someone to accept Christ, and he believes in nothing, I think I'm spinning my wheels. But if the man has a sense of reasoning, and I can reason, and I can start showing the reasons, and I can meet them on their grounds to show them that I should refute some of their thinking, I think would have an opportunity to have the fellow say, why can't he say that? So I think youngsters have to be able to understand that there is a plurality in this society, a plurality of philosophical thought, and it's really not a hard one to tackle when you really look at it, because the concept that Fletcher preaches, which always bothered me, is that one can take an action and judge an action, and the morality of it is based on the situation. It depended on the conditions and the time. That's fine, except then I can never get a general principle that I can apply to life, because each action is going to vary. And how can I get general principles that vary with X number of situations, and I wind up with X principles. In essence, I have no general principle. And I think it's a system that defeats itself. And I think the ability to do that. Now, when I get into the other thing of mind control, and I think one of the big problems we have today is we have the ability to change people's behavior. Now, how do we do that? We can do that in a multitude of manners. Let's divide them with chemicals. And I think you're familiar with the chemical techniques that they have in the psychiatric institutions, or even a doctor. You take Valium. That's active control. In essence, the mind control is a mood control. A mood is a mind-controlling thing. We have chemical, psychotropic drugs. And we have electrical stimulation, electrical techniques of physiological control. Now, some of these are reversible and some are irreversible. And the question is, what are we going to try to reverse? Now, you mentioned somebody that lived in a tree. Now, is that an abnormal behavior that requires modification? Was the man productive in a society? Must my behavior be exactly like everyone else's behavior? I think there even were the tendencies in the 50s to say all children that went to school had to become extroverts. And there are kids that are an extrovert, and yet are not abnormal. So, in a sense, that was an attempt through suasion of mind control, behavioral control. And so the question comes up, what are we going to try to control? Well, I think when you do this, you are intruding on an individual externally and internally. And one, you externally on his behavioral pattern, internally on his thought processes. Now, if I intrude on a behavioral pattern, I should have a reason for that intrusion. Is that intrusion because the behavior is going to be harmful to himself and harmful in a true sense? Is it going to be harmful to the society in which the man finds himself? He's an inmate of a hospital. Is he going to be dangerous to the inmate? Are, that is the one thing. Now, that will be behavioral. A behaviorist is interested more in how the individual responds. Am I interested in changing his mental processes? This is an entirely different thing. How does the man think? It might be that he's thinking properly. Do we need an example like Martha Mitchell, who was constrained in a motel because she was thinking properly, I think. And do we have to go to Russia alone? We've had our examples in this country with the un-American activities of what was going on, and some of it perhaps was real, and some of it perhaps was not real. So we have that kind of control. But when societies were able to throw people in prison, it was fine. But now with the idea of giving them this medication, which may actually cause not only the change in behavior, but their ability then to communicate, their ability to think, their ability to do abstract thinking. And do we have a right to do that? And under what conditions do we have a right to do that? Not all mental illness means, incidentally, that the patient does not have the ability to be competent to make the decision to enter into the treatment. Can we force this treatment on anybody? Do we force this treatment on somebody in an institution because it's a nuisance to us to have a patient complaining all the time? That might be the reason. It may be for our benefit, not for anybody else's, and not the patient's benefit. And is there a point, then, when this has to be controlled? That is, we have to control that act. And the courts becoming very aware of this. We can control behavior that may be abnormal, but may be very productive to society. Do we want to do that? Do we want to give medications that cause a flattening of the affection or the how we behave? Just complete loss of that in a man like Van Gogh, who can paint, wasn't harming anyone, or somebody living in a tree that's doing good research, or, do we want to change that behavior? And if we do, does the patient have a right to enter into that agreement? But once he enters in it, it's somewhat different from entering into an experiment, because once you've given psychotropic drugs, his mentation processes are now distorted. And therefore, does he have the capability of saying, I want to discontinue, and is he now competent? So who protects the man or the woman that's on that drug? And if you do put somebody on a drug, is it best to modify the behavior and then desert the individual? Or must it be required, must there be a moral responsibility that you don't put anybody on a drug of that sort unless you intend to follow it up with a therapy that's going to do more than modify that behavior? And that's important. So if you go to some of these homes where they have these people on heavy doses of psychotropics and watch them in their inanimate vegetative state, you wonder, do we have a human being? If the definition we used this morning of the essence of a human being was there. I'm not saying that that man has no value. It has value. Now, some of these psychotropic drugs can cause irreversible damage. You can get a dyskinesia. And so that one can create some harm. And it's fine to start out with somebody who says, I want to participate, but who can force an individual into this? The courts require, in fact, that where cases have come up, that any such activity must be demonstrated that the individual was not competent to make his decision, that the treatment has got to be good, and it's got to be aimed at a purpose. So in some ways, the ethics and law have really, which again, that's part of our society. I mean, we're all in one society. We're looking at it from different views. But there are protecting this thing. Now, if you take the psychosurgery, which irreversible, totally irreversible. For whose benefit do we do that? The ability to think is totally altered. Memory, the learning, is gone. And the ability for abstract thinking can be gone. What do you have left? And now, when I say psychosurgery, I'm not saying surgery for epilepsy, because that's good. There is a way of determining a focal spot when there's damage, or a brain tumor, or something. It sometimes can have the exact opposite effect. I know a fellow was admitted to the Mass General Hospital because he was a banker up in Maine, and everybody in town knew he was a louse. And suddenly, his behavior changed, and his wife brought him to the Massachusetts General Hospital. She knew there was something wrong with the husband because people were starting to like him. That's literally true. And they worked on him, and they found he had a meningioma, which is a tumor of the sheath of the brain, in the frontal lobe, which is pressing on the frontal lobes, which in part control your behavior. Well, they operated on him, and he was back to where he was as a banker in Maine with his, no longer with his recently acquired friend. Now the question is, was harm done? Was good not? And perhaps the good Lord was trying to save him with some of his own psychosurgery. But the important thing is there is surgery that is of value. We're not talking about surgery. We're talking about the surgery strictly with the intent of changing the behavior and mentation of an individual. And that, I think, is something that should perhaps be relegated to the old area where the Egyptians used to make holes in the head to relieve the humors and stuff. I think it's totally irreversible. However, you have other things. You have the implantation of electrodes that can be done in the brain. And you can actually implant these electrodes and have the people experience feelings of delight. Or you can change their mood. Now, with the micro-electrode techniques that we have, it's not impossible, and this is done, by the way, it's been done on some women, female patients. They put in the wires and they wore wigs. So they had, but can you imagine now with these micro-receivers, the control of the behavior? You say, well, that's far-fetched. Well, is it far-fetched? I have a pen in here that's telling me the times, the dates, the seconds, and that little top over there in the micro-circuitry that exists today is quite good. Now, we all think that man is interested in man, but we had to think of Reinhold Niebuhr, who said that man's propensity for injustice requires that we have our safeguards. And I think it's an important thing. So that it's a thing that requires that society, and when I say that, that means all of us. And I think our role as Christians should be to take the lead in this thinking. And I don't think we all ought to overlook it. Because a lot of the moral concepts, the moral philosophies that were the regeneration, I think, we owe to some of our more of the theologians, Tillich and some of the others that came in. Since the 40s and 30s and 40s and 50s and Barth. And I think we owe it to them, and I think they led the way. We are responsible, and we should be setting the pace, and we should be educating our ministers who will be out in the field to be able to make intelligent decisions. They should be able to read so that they could understand and face some of these moral dilemmas that we have. To give you a good idea, I picked up the paper today before I took a nap. And just interesting. Are we preparing everybody in the ministry? Now, this is today's paper. It's a St. Louis paper, and I had no planning on it. Foster parents were paid less than kennels charged. And we talked today about man's ability to deal. How does he behave? It takes the essence of man requires not only a functioning part, but the ability to think. The economy is necessary. It has to impinge. The economy, the environment, helps develop a man or a woman's potential. Now, at foster parents, a kennel gets $8.50 in here a day. And foster parents are paid $3.84 to $5.39. Now, is that an ethical problem? Is that a medical problem? Medicine is not just science. Medicine is the total care of man. Is that a spiritual problem? As I said, Christ first served fish and bread before he gave his sermon on the mount. We have another one. Suit seeks $1 million in damage. This is on the same page. Suit seeks $1 million in damage for alleged strip search victim, 16-year-old girl who was in an abortion clinic, which in itself is a problem. Well, there's a little bit more. It's a very interesting newspaper. I really just picked it up, and somewhere along here, somebody is now saying in Washington that a moral dilemma, should an 18-year-old girl, anyone under 18, receive birth control devices or instructions or pills without the parents knowing it? Is that an ethical moral problem, both for a physician and for the clergy and for society. Yes, sir, I have another nice one in here. Oh, yes. Mailer says he feels responsible in killing. Mailer, Norman Mailer. Which is also, can a rational being think and think through one's actions? As we were talking today, man has a habit of being very emotional, and I do. God comes, has to forgive me daily. The Italian in me comes out. I sometimes get more emotional than I think. And was that the thing? Maybe we'll overlook that one. I have a better one. Oh, yeah. There we are. I thought this was a very excellent from the discussion. Do you mind if I read this letter to the editor? Is there a light here? The recent letters regarding the black backlash against science illustrate how little most people understand science. By itself, science is only a method of learning. Science does not say what is to be learned. It only asks that what is accepted as knowledge be proven as observable evidence. The idea that the best explains the facts and predicts future facts through experimentation is tentatively accepted until a better idea is found. The rules of science parallel the rules of evidence that any reasonable man would expect in a court of law. Appeals to authority, emotion, greed, insecurity do not constitute evidence. This man obviously would not accept reasoning on moral or values of science. The mere simultaneous occurrence of two facts does not mean that these facts are related. If these rules are not followed in the practical course of science, then the cause is human and not the method. A great strength of science is that it frees man from having to use God or some other religious belief as an explanation. This does not mean that God can never be an explanation, but in a free world of ideas, every idea must prove its worthiness and cannot be legislated into acceptance. Through science, man is free to find that the idea which works in this world and from which he makes other ideas work. What man does is his own fault. There is nothing in evidence, not except that, see? And there is his own fault. And there is nothing in science that says an atomic bomb must be dropped, that poisonous chemicals must contaminate the world, or that life-saving medicines must be used. These things are man's choice. Science itself is not greedy or reckless, but there is nothing in it that makes a man generous or cautious if he is not inclined to be so. It is society that provides those qualifications. Science should not be made the scapegoat. Science is neutral. It cannot be otherwise. It's humans that give it a bad or good name. Now, the point I'm getting here, this Dr. Montgomery fails to recognize by saying it's society, he takes the burden off of the scientist. You see, it's so easy to use the third person to escape responsibility. There's a couple of other interesting things in here. So I think that this is an excuse that we use, and I think that's an excellent example of someone raised by an educational system which has had its roots about the 1890s, the 1850s, when people said we have to measure things, and fail to recognize that other things may not be measurable, they're non-cognitive, but they are equally true, and I think this is what a humanities program helps a person acquire. And I think that letter is just excellent to point out the deficiencies of the preparation of someone interested in science. And I'm rather intrigued that many of our philosophers used to be physicians. It's unfortunate that many have become so tied up with the technology that they cease to be philosophers. And I wonder if that doesn't happen sometimes with the ministry. Is it possible that could be happening at times? when we get so tied up with our method of doing things that we fail to relate this to the humanness of our activity and create something. Did I overstep my bounds, do you think? I mean, I'm a guest in your house. And I apologize if I was rude. The paternalistic. And medicine has been paternalistic. And in some churches, the priests have been paternalistic. I think we're getting away from that. And I think it's wholesome, you know, when they threw open the doors at the Vatican for the concept that we are not going to dictate the behavior. This internalization of the gospel is really the internalization of the Old Testament, isn't it? There are people that want to make these decisions, and this is what's been wrong with patient-doctor relationship. You put your finger on it. The old patient-doctor relationship, in fact, the Hippocratic Oath demands it, practically. And it demands it. And it's wrong. Now the patient has to be brought in as a rational human being to participate in that therapy, particularly now when you have so many subdivisions in the practice of medicine that it becomes so confusing. How many of you have been in a hospital and saw 10 doctors or somebody seeing you 10 different occasions? You might be interested in knowing that. If you think you are confused, a Roman wrote, "There are so many specialists in Rome that I do not know who to see." Does history repeat itself? And I think it's unfortunate that we don't recognize it. And this, by the way, you'll find that in those are my favorite reading books at my bedside. I know that most historians probably knock them as the story of Durant, Bolinario Durant's book, and he's got that out of there. He really did, and there's a chapter about Caesar and Christ. I was really amused when I came across that particular part. But it's volume. But I think we become confused by the specialization. And what happens during the specialization? A doctor comes in with a thing, and he's going to do something with a thing to you. And how often have we had the opportunity to sit down with a doctor without a thing and talk? And somebody put everything together. This is where I think if you're trading people for hospital work, as pastoral care, I think, is an area that should be strongly considered to teach the individual sometimes how to be a patient advocate, to be able to say, "Joe, I know you're having a problem. Well, I'll see if I can get Dr. Stan to talk to you about this," or at least to teach them how to relate to the doctor and say, and without apologies, "I was just talking to your patient," which doesn't reveal a confidentiality. "He is confused about something." And I think that is a role that can be played, and I think that would make a strong relationship in the long run with that patient and the clergy that may actually survive his illness, which may be a value, because I think patients feel lost in the modern hospital setting with the modern technology. Talk to most people, and it's very interesting. I've had the opportunity to talk to people. They're frightened. Put them in an intensive care unit. They're frightened. And what happens in an intensive care unit? A doctor comes in and says, "Joe, your blood pressure is great. It's 140 over 90. No, yesterday it was 200 over 20. Well, 120, and now your heartbeat is excellent, Joe. And Bim walks out of the room. And is that a human relationship? You see. And he's lucky if he has somebody say that. Or they walk into the room and say, how is our myocardial infarct patient doing? And you see, instead of saying, how is Dr. Potts doing, or how is Rocco doing, or how is Joe doing? The best doctor I knew was a very brilliant man whose father, in fact, was professor of pathology at St. Louis in Washington University. His name was William Dock, George Dock. One of the first fellows to determine what really was a myocardial infarct. Did it very cleverly. He didn't have fancy equipment. He just used little scissors and some loops and determined about the blockage. His son, William Bach, was a very brilliant man. And I always enjoyed watching Dr. Dock, who was very well-read, very astute, treat the prostitute as well as the dowager. In fact, one wondered who was the dowager and who was the prostitute. And I don't use that word in the sense, again, of judging. But in Brooklyn, we did have a large, but he treated each and every one of them like a lady and spoke to them. Some of them probably would never spoken to like that before. But these are the things that we have to get out. And sometimes I think we see within ourselves the hateful individual, the hateful parishioner, and how do we speak to them, you know? And I think these are things that we have to learn. And I think we miss this in our training, and I think this is what I think seminarians have to be aware of as lawyers, as pre-medical students, and as anybody in any walk of life has to be. I probably have said too much on these things, but these are things that I convey against not only here but also at home. So I find that I have the advantage of having each Wednesday 12 medical students. I miss them today because of this, but my associate took them over. The one thing I always like to bring across to them is the fact that when I'm showing them organs, they came from the patient. And I frequently ask them, how do you think the patient behaves? Just to get them off the track, to make them understand that there's feelings in people, and to do that. And it's rather remarkable how they do understand what you're trying to get across to them, you know. The idea of holistic medicine is an old concept. That's nothing brand new. The Arabs knew this. When they said in the year 500, it's not the medicine you give, but how you give it that makes a difference.
Where did you put hypnosis in your treatment?
Oh, I think it's a viable option. Of course, that depends on who's doing the hypnosis. You know, does the individual, is it a parlor game? I'm not insulting you when I say that. Is it a parlor game or some people play it? Does the doctor know once I've got somebody in a state of hypnosis what to do? You know, I've got a tool set at home. But if I take my car apart, it'll never come together. And I think hypnosis falls in that category. What do I expect to accomplish with hypnosis? Am I skilled enough to say, now that I have gotten this accomplished, What can I achieve? To hypnotize somebody and expect the impossible, you know very well, you're not going to hypnotize me and tell me you're going to get thin tomorrow. Number one, I'll laugh at you because I know it's not going to work. And because it takes a heck of a lot more. You don't change these patterns. A good psychologist who does want to use hypnosis, not all of them will, we use it infrequently, and you're in psychology, and you might be able to help me out. will use it infrequently, but they use it well, a well-trained psychologist. The idea of using it for recall, as police do, and stuff like that, has been questioned. In fact, it's been shown almost to be inaccurate, too. What's been your experience with hypnosis? Hypnosis does not... In hypnosis, the one, the old fancy thing that you can actually make a patient, the person, be under your control at all time. It depends what you're trying to control, and it goes against a strong moral will of an individual. Nothing. That will not work. Am I correct on that? Yeah, and what about the result that you're trying to achieve? Sure, the perception of an individual, for example, how an individual perceives things can't be changed too well. And that's another thing in mind control. If you're going to give drugs that change my perception of things, that's dangerous. You can do that more with drugs than you can with hypnosis. Another thing you can do with drugs that I didn't mention is actually make their mood totally different from what the individual is. Take the hallucinatory drugs, for example. And is that a proper thing? And don't forget, the Army experimented with those. The CIA did, and the Army did. Against the will, unknowingly, with people, which to me was a heck of an immorality. Oh, yeah, sure, but the people wanted to be helped. And in hypnosis, now I'm not an expert in this, it is one way of getting into that individual to get them to relate and to get to talk about these things. One can almost achieve the same thing in the longer term in a constant interview, constant recalling, but in hypnosis you may cut down the time in which this is done. Now again, I'm not an expert in it, but that person, first of all, wanted to get over that fear. You see, if that person recognized that there was an abnormal reaction and wanted to understand and was brought to some sort of an understanding. The point is, you don't hypnotize somebody and think, tomorrow you can go out on that airplane or stand on the 100th floor of that downtown Manhattan, and you're going to be okay, because the chances I don't jump off, or fall off, or not. But it takes, in other words, it's a methodology that's used. Yeah, but the patient wants to relax, and the patient wants to discuss what's... The patient has an inhibition, can't discuss his tension, can't discuss the source. And under hypnosis, there is that relaxation. But if Dr. Henschke or anyone else practicing it does not have a certain fidelity between he and the patient, there isn't going to be any relaxation. There's got to be, first of all, you don't just start out hypnotizing people. First of all, you win their confidence. You try to tell them what you're going to achieve. It's part of informed consent. The informed consent's been with us for a long time. It was a very moral thing to do, to tell people, look, Joe, we're going to have to do this. I don't know if it's going to work, but here's what may happen. It may not happen that way. You know, that was informed. If you think back when you were a child or something, you saw a doctor or somebody, and they talked to you like that, and in a sense, it was an oral informed consent. But I think we got so busy being so busy, not knowing why we're busy, that we even fail to tell the people what we're going to do to them. That's why all this nonsense of informed consent has come up. It's not nonsense. It's a very important thing. We have gotten so busy in this world, and we don't know what we're achieving, that we fail to do this. And that is part of your therapy. You're talking to the patient what I expect to achieve. and let you know. And this is what makes it is part of the treatment, really. A good informed, obtaining a good informed consent can sometimes be a beneficial aspect for a patient in ameliorating the disease state. Because I would hate to come out of an operation frightened or go into it getting frightened. But if I'm told what my chances are, what the complications may be, I don't want to know as the minutest one. I think a doctor has a responsibility. You know, don't worry, we're prepared to handle this complication. And so you go in relaxed, you see. And you lower parts of your brain are not putting out serotonin and causing epinephrine to go around, which makes your heart feel irregularly. And so.
I like very much what you said about passion and the advocacy role for the patient is concerned.
Yeah. There are many. Well, that's fine. And that's the patient's privilege. The important thing is the patients should know. Should know what's going on. And I'm a pathologist, and I get up on the floors and I make do bone marrows and I get to see the people with generally sundry hematological blood diseases. And frequently, I'm the one that has to tell the patient what they have. I have never lied to a patient. And I can say that, including my sister. But I lay the groundwork first. I mean, I don't bounce in a room and say something. It's interesting. Some of the doctors just do not know how to approach it. I will also say, if I may, I have seen some of the clergy not know. Indeed, in 61, 62, we started, I don't know if any of you know Pastor Mazak. Pastor Mazak, and a lot of Graves, and a couple of other ministers, my Methodist minister, Reverend Herrick, we got together. Well, first of all, we had to get together. There's a strong anti-Catholic, anti-Protestant feeling in the community. That was a very horrible thing. And we, Mazak wouldn't even come to the hospital until he had a real incarcerated hernia. And then one of my friends, Dr. Fredericks, brought him in, and I got up and talked to him. Pretty soon he got to realize everything was pretty good, and his whole attitude changed. And I know why, and he had reasons for his attitude. And it was not that Mazak was without reason for his attitude. It wasn't anti-Catholic per se, but how certain manipulations, politics, you know, does play games in the thing. But soon we wound up with a clergy association that was the most effective clergy association I think I have ever seen. And it had just about eight of the strongest individuals who were willing. The only one was the Wisconsin Synod, Mississippi. But everyone else did. And we had a superb opportunity to have discussions. And it made a big difference. And the things that we discussed is how to talk to patients that have cancer. Because the patient has a diagnosis of cancer, a lot of the clergy didn't understand it. So we had a session for the clergy way back in 60-61. Look, you can have a cancer of the skin, which is of no significance. And you can have cancer and all of this. Now, I appreciate the clergy going in and praying with the patient. But I hate when they tempt God with a miracle. Any more than saying, you know, when the devil got Christ on the cliff and said, you know, why don't you get it turned into bread, you know, those rocks? I think we sometimes tend to do that. You know, we still have to say God's will be done. And I don't think we do anybody a favor if we say we're going to pray for your miracle. and I think it's a disservice. It's not only a disservice, I even think it's unchristian. I even think it's ungodly, because I think what you're trying to do is impose your will on God. And it doesn't do any good for the patient. And I think if we can only get them to say, I have to encourage this patient to recognize that therapy may ameliorate, may prolong life. And this is the opportunity I take when I get to talk to people. I never give them bad news without the idea that there's also hope in the situation. And the one thing I always like to tell them, there's only one difference between you and me. And that is, you know you have cancer. And I don't know if I have cancer. Now, and I always tell them, and it's always been fairly effective, I don't know if I'm going to see you tomorrow. Because I don't know what's going to happen to me on my way home. And I remember telling this to a patient, and my husband, who's a good friend of mine, had a cancer of the rectum. And I told, I says, Rose, Victor has his cancer of the rectum. We've examined the specimen. It's an extensive cancer. It's in the lymph nodes. I know for a fact he's got it in the liver, but you know, it's a new chemotherapy. And I says, Rose, I could be driving home tonight, and I could hit an automobile. And I'll be gone long before anybody else is. None of us have a contract in life as to what we're going to do. She came back the next day. She says, you know, Rocco, I was driving on the Lake Five, and all of a sudden a car came through and didn't and ran a stop sign. And suddenly I realized I could have been dead before Victor was. And it suddenly dawned on her that we, none of us, have a lease on life. In fact, isn't it part, and you can think it's in the Lutheran hymnal, isn't there a part in one of the services? In fact, it goes way back before the Reformation. God protect us from a sudden and unexpected death. I still think it's part of the service, isn't it? And the litany. And I think it was brought in mainly to bring this home. And I don't think we bring this home to patients or parishioners, that none of us have a lease on life. And because we have this kind of a diagnosis made, that it necessarily means that we are going to have a horrible death or anything, you know. And the other thing I always like to bring out to the people when I talk to them, and is St. Paul's statement that the Lord does not put any burden on our shoulders when he doesn't give us an equal amount of strength to bear that. And I really believe it, because I've seen it so often with people that they actually could bear pain. And I'm sure you've seen people bear some disease processes so very extensively. You see families that can bear the burden. And I think these are important things, that we have to get these across to the people. And I think this is what I'd like to see the clergy do. Unfortunately, I see something among the clergy, as I see among the physicians. We have become we've become so structured that I think we sometimes lose our purpose. And now every hospital has a department of religion. As if to say to the people that work in that hospital, that is my job. And you know, who said that the woman that cleans the floor can't be a vehicle for Christ or God to say something good to that patient? Because I've seen that happen, you know? And I think we've structured it. I've seen the Protestant hospitals do it, well, they really got it well organized. In a Catholic hospital, and if you go into some of those hospitals between certain hours, you can't see some of them because they're in a conference discussing the patient. As I said to one of you before, I'll be doggone if I want to discuss my inner feelings with any clergy if he's going to go to a conference and make a case out of it. It's my business and his business. It comes back to the hospital chart, incidentally, which bothers me, and it's been bothering me ever since. What do we put on a hospital chart? And who has access to that hospital chart? Every Tom, Dick, and Harry have been... Now, everybody wears a stethoscope. Stethoscopes have become more or less now a symbol. It's now worn around the neck in a loose-hanging fashion. Seldom are the two holes connected to the ears, which connect to the brain. But it's worn as a symbol of authority. I mean, we have a nice, clean white coat most of the time. It's always clean, which always bothers me. And my point is, we have developed symbolism. And have we gone to the point now where everyone wants to be a clinician, and are we developing symbolism in the chaplaincies in the hospital? And is that something for us to guard against? I don't know what the answer to that is. I'm not saying someone working in a hospital should not be prepared for it. Now, I don't want that mistaken. But what are they to say to the patient? And how are they to react with the patient? And I'm not so sure that one should not dissect and pay close attention to this responsibility. It is a ministry, really. And I think it's an excellent ministry to be in, because I think you'll find people quite receptive when they're ill. But I think, too, it can't be on a structured basis. I think it bothers people. And I think another thing that bothers people that I have noticed, if you have two or more chaplains, Joe's off today, he's off skiing, so I'm covering for him. Is there anything you really need? Okay. I think it's like when a physician signs out to somebody else. And are we doing that? And is that something that we should the doctor, should the chaplain go up and talk to him and say, look, I'm going to be leaving town and the other thing we have is we put a big cross on the front of the building. We have a department of the chaplaincy, and we don't take care of the morality of the business transactions. I maintain that there's no such thing as a non-profit institution. In fact, I'm getting facts together on it, but there is no such thing as a non-profit institution since Medicare and Medicaid has come in. Whom do you have in your hospital? You have a business agent who immediately goes up to find out if the bill can be paid. In some cases, they'll do this before the patient's admitted. And yet we have a cross on the building. And I would almost think it would be good if we paint that cross blue sometimes. And I think that is a role that we have to say. If a hospital claims that it's Christian, I think the hospital has to be able to sustain its loss and pray that somehow that loss will be made up. I'm not saying that they should not be good stewards. I'm not that foolish. But I think we have abdicated the running of what we call Christian hospitals, and Jewish hospitals for that matter, to lay people who have no background in Christian morality and concepts. And have we done a disservice then? Something really worthwhile. I happen to be talking at the Catholic Hospital Association. I'm at the rambling mood now, and you're going to have to stop me. I was talking...
Let me just check with you at that point. What time do you want to stop?
I can, I'll just finish this and we'll have some tea.
Oh,
I was at the Catholic Hospital Association in 1965, 68 in Wisconsin. And a discussion came up among all the different brothers, fathers, and sisters. I was asked to go and talk on abortion. They give them the medical reasons for abortion. I was asked by my good friend, Father Glazen and Senior Murphy, who were the speakers on the thing. And I was there, and I was sitting on the podium, waiting for my turn to tell all these good people all about abortion. And I heard something that really made me think about the role of a Christian hospital. And it said, and again, I am not writing them because I made a statement there, and I think I heard some of the chaplains get up and say, you know, we take care of a lot of the girls at Chiquita, the women's prison, and you know, you can talk all you want about abortion, you can talk all you want about this, but you know, we have to listen to them, and you know, they got all these problems, and we have to consider all of these. And that was one, you know, and I think, yes, I can sympathize with problems, but if I have a certain standard, I will not compromise my standard while I seek a solution to a problem. I just sat there and listened to several people talk like this. Then I heard another get up and said, what are we going to do? We are one of the only hospitals in our community. And the doctors want us to tie tubes and they want us to do abortions. And the Hill-Burton Fund people state that since we received Hill-Burton funds and under the time that they were doing that, we have to serve or else have to return and all sorts of things, which was a very interesting thing. And this went on and on to discussing how were they going to face the issues. And I'm afraid I did not speak on abortion at the time because I thought it was less important. Because it reminded me when the fellows that wanted to hear something for the girls, how to get along nicely with them, when Paul said, we like to hear the things that will tickle our ears. And I pointed out that that is what I think I heard. But the other thing that I had to learn was that they were concerned about how their hospital would stay open because of the Hill-Burton Fund. And I said it reminded me how fortunate the early Christians were, because if they were thrown into an arena with lions, it was a horrible, quick death, but they died with their faith. But the modern lion is economical and gives them plenty of opportunity to change their faith, which is obvious that they were considering, and we are therefore under the economics. So easy to say, well, you know, we have to acquiesce in this. And I said, you know, and I gave him, this is my last story. I said, when I was a youngster, I said, I find just one thing missing in this meeting. I said, when I was a youngster on the east side of New York, I always said I wanted to be a doctor. And this went on for a long time. And I was getting ready to graduate from high school, and God, you know, made counselors. And my counselor brought me in and said, well, Rocco, what are you going to do? I said, well, I'm going to be a doctor. He says, what does your father do? I said, well, he digs ditches for the New York Edison Company. And she said, well, you know, it's expensive to be a doctor. You know, and if you've got to have realistic plans, and you have to be able to achieve these, and you should have alternate routes and use all the nomenclature. It was really down pat. No, really. And I was really crushed. And she says, Rocco, why don't you bring your mother and we'll have a discussion? Well, my mother was a typical Italian peasant woman. And my mother was always very respectful of people and always expected us to be respectful of people, particularly if they were educated. She sat there and listened to every argument. And then, and I told them, then this woman asked my mother, "What do you think, Mrs. Lavaraca?" And my mother said, in an Italian English dialect, that if God wants my son to be a doctor, he's going to be a doctor. He don't want him to be a doctor, he's not going to be a doctor. And I said, you know, it took me many years to realize, but I saw the crystallization of faith at that particular moment. And I said, it was something I found missing in that conflict. Because I really think that we that run hospitals that supposedly are Christian should have enough confidence that we could run these hospitals in a truly Christian fashion from the time of admission to the time of discharge and to how the people in that hospital are treated. Because I find the employees treated in less than Christian manner in some of our Christian hospitals. And with that, I think I'll not bore you anymore.